Live from the front yard inside Ellis Island Casino, it's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Here we go. All right, Monday Night Football on the way in about 20 minutes. Cofield and Company live up until 6. Game kicks off, like I said, around 5:20. We'll take you through this hour with some breakdown of the Raiders, UFC 306. Also, UNLV's win at Kansas. That's all coming up. Happy hour still going on. Front yard, Ellis Island. $7 bites, $7 drinks. I'm slow sipping a jalapeno pineapple margarita. Real good. The bites? I mean, come on. Bacon, mac and cheese, beer brine wings, brisket sliders, giant pretzel, drive-in burger, truffle, parmesan fries. All $7. That's crazy. There's also an all-you-can-drink beer special, all-you-can-eat special here, and that's on Mondays, Sundays, and Thursdays for pro football, and Saturdays for college football. The menu here is great. Awesome. Willie's here, back in the Finley Toyota Studios. It's Griffin. Willie does some of his best work off of Cofield & Company. He just gives out his great takes on local TV. Fire this as Willie addresses the Raiders out of the gates, 1-1, but what a win yesterday against the Ravens. Now the lowly Panthers come in, and Willie is pressed on, hey, dude, how is this going to work moving forward?
Simple. You look in the mirror and you realize that this week's Panthers are last week's Raiders. Ooh. Understand that the Panthers are coming in with a desire to win, and they, when nobody had the Raiders beating the Ravens, nobody has the Panthers beating the Raiders. So you cannot count anybody out. It's only week three. Anything could be, you know, attributed. The one thing I will say about that defense, one of three teams in the NFL to hold their opponents under 30% on third downs in each of the first two games this season, and mistake-free, committed only three penalties for 15 yards. So far this season, the Raiders, five penalties, tied for second fewest in the NFL. So mistake-free, staunch defense, continue to build the chemistry on offense.
Wow, you sound really good there when someone's not cutting you off incessantly.
Well, they're a little more professional on television.
They are.
And they're not a bully. They're not overbearing.
I mean, they don't know sports, so that's the difference. Although I did follow Evan Schreiber today, so he seems like a nice guy.
They're really cool.
I'm busting chops. So.
There's a young man that used to be part of the Golden Knights, like intern, when they bring the college kids in the game day night ops, and they've all graduated and gotten their jobs over the years. I think I brought that up and mentioned it. We talked about that on Stanley Cup reaction the week after, and yes, it was there a moment. If you remember, I said it was getting to see those game night operations guys raise the cup and get their part with it. A lot of the kids that we deal with. Ryan is a producer at Channel 3, which puts ARC Las Vegas on, so I appreciate him reaching out. And now it seems like every Sunday he's at, hey, you're coming on, right? You're coming on. So now I'm a part of the Monday show. But, yes.
When's your birthday?
May 11th.
I'm going to get you a post-birthday gift.
Okay.
Let's get a lav mic. A little lavalier mic.
What is that?
Lavalier mic. Little mic. Little microphone.
Oh, gotcha.
Little mic. I like microphones.
The lav mic, yes.
Yes, yeah, please.
Instead of talking into the...
Yeah. Giveaway time. Just some... We all need it. We all need to sound good. Trans-Siberian Orchestra in town on the 29th of November. Tickets are on sale at Ticketmaster.com, although the copy doesn't say that. Let's change that. Ticketmaster.com, Orleans Arena. I love Christmas music. I'm so jealous of everyone who gets to go to it. I'm going to be in Phoenix during that time. But two tickets right now, 364-1100, 364-1100, Trans-Siberian Orchestra, Orleans. Get your tickets, Ticketmaster.com. Okay, let's turn our attention back to the Raiders. Let's go to Southern California, where we know some of the best Raiders fans reside. It's time to talk some UFC 306 and some Raiders with our Raiders insider. He's a good Raiders opinion guy. RJ, are you an insider? Are you an insider?
I can see inside my TV and watch the game as soon as everyone else.
Exactly.
Are you an insider? Tell me.
I think oftentimes insiders...
Observer.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that's it, exactly. Insiders are afraid to say what they really want to say, and I know you're going to tell us what's going on. Autumn Windbags Podcast is where you can hear RJ every week. All right. I think you'll have some critiques, but coming out of the game, that's a damn good win in a situation where I think a lot of people were like, man, the Raiders are in trouble. They're going to start out the season 0-2. What went right?
I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, like, talk about a stage set for failure. Going across the country to the Ravens, playing another Harbaugh when they're on a long week and ticked off because they got how they feel robbed by the Chiefs. And the Raiders had just an abysmal offensive performance, only 10 points. A defense that slowed down. And what kind of team would take advantage of a tiring defense better than a Harbaugh team with Derrick Henry? Like, the stage was set for severe disappointment, which is why they were 9-point dogs. And honestly, the game started off the same as last week against the Chargers. The first, like, 2.5 quarters, it was no offense, defense keeping us in it, but they could only do so much. The rushing game was zil, a complete facepalm interception by Gardner, or turnover by Gardner Minshew. And then I don't know if it was the pep talk we saw Max Crosby give Gardner. I don't know if it was because Luke Getsy finally said, hey, let's just start throwing it to wide open Devontae Adams and Brock Bowers. But the passing game took over. The passing game took over. We started getting some drives together. And that, of course, gave the defense a chance to rest a little bit, get the three and outs and the sacks we needed in the fourth quarter. And it was just, there was a turn. I know it's only two, but there was a turning point in that third quarter that felt like could have been a turning point for this season. Because it looked like exactly what was going to happen last week was going to happen this week.
RJ, and you talk about turning points. For me, I thought the key moment to keep the spirits up was when Max Crosby went into Gardner Minshew's face and said, hey, shake it off. Don't worry about it after throwing the pick. We got you. We'll get you that ball back. He's the leader of this team. Antonio Pierce said it earlier that he was the best player on the field, or said it after the game, excuse me. How good can this defense be, especially with him as the leader?
I tell you what, man, if I could, I would pay $100 for that audio just so I could have it be my alarm clock in the morning. Because if you get a pep talk from Max Crosby at 5 a.m., you're getting stuff done that day, right? Like, it definitely turned Gardner Minshew around. And you're right. Like, Max Crosby is the heart and soul of that defense. He's the heart and soul of that entire team. No one works harder. He played every single snap again. He's so effective. But he's got a lot of help now. Christian Wilkins was a fantastic free signing. He's worth every single dime we're paying. And Robert Spillane is the most productive player on the defense. Max Crosby, the superstar, the best player, et cetera. But no one's more productive than Spillane with that interception, 10 tackles, pass deflects. He's all over the place. Jack Jones with a super key breakup in the fourth quarter to keep it from getting in field goal range on that final drive. The DB stepped up huge. The linebackers played great. I mean, the only knock you can give this defense, really, is they're not getting a lot of takeaways, right? They got one this week, zero last week. Other than that, they're playing fantastic. If they can stay healthy, this should be a top-10 defense.
We saw the same lackluster effort in the first half in Inglewood in week one, in Baltimore in week two. What was different this week that you saw? Why did the offense get better?
I think it was Luke Getsy saying, offensive coordinator Luke Getsy saying, look, he's trying, like, I get what they're trying to do, and it made perfect sense. You want to run a one running back, two tight end set, start pushing the run game. When the defense starts playing heavy, you start using, instead of using Brock Bowers and Michael Mayer, the tight ends, as blockers, you use them as receivers. And that was always the plan. The problem is if you can never get the run game going, the defense isn't going to respect your set. They're not going to load the box. They're not going to look at Brock Bowers or Michael Mayer as any important blockers, so we're just going to keep it heavy, right? Or we're going to keep playing the defense we want to play. And at 1.6 yards per carry, you can't blame opposing defenses for not caring about the run. So at some point, Luke Getsy just said, Minshew, we're going Air Minshew. Just start swinging the ball. Devontae Adams got 12 targets. Brock Bowers got 9. They each got 9 receptions, basically 100 yards for each of them. And that is credit. I think Getsy deserves credit, Gardner Minshew deserves credit, but the most of the credit should go to Devontae and Brock Bowers, who just got themselves wide open. I mean, Devontae had two really bad drops, but other than that, how do you let Devontae Adams run free on a field? Like, what are you thinking? How do you let Brock Bowers run free? They just find a way to get open, and all Minshew had to do was find his receiver.
Speaking with R.J. Clifford. So, R.J., let me ask you this. Zamir White, okay, last year, plays the last four games. I feel there wasn't a lot of pressure on him because Josh Jacobs was still there, so he's just going to go out and do his thing, right, and run. I've been using this phrase for 2 weeks, with a deliberate nature. Now I feel like he is a little apprehensive. Maybe he feels the onus is on him. He's feeling a little bit of pressure. We haven't seen him run like the guy that they drafted, a different regime. I get it. But does he even fit in this offensive scheme?
It's not looking like it so far. And in fairness to him, the offensive line and the run blocking has been abysmal. Absolutely terrible. I think they're 32nd in EPA per rush. They're 32nd in success rate, 31st in yards before first contact per rush. I mean, he is getting zero help, which it shouldn't be that big of a surprise, right? Colton Miller was rushed back after shoulder surgery. Jackson Bauer Johnson's our second-round guard. He's not ready to play it because of concussion issues. So he's not getting help, one. Two, they went from a gap scheme to a zone scheme, which – you know, Zeus is a power runner, right? He's not a super elusive, find your hole and go. He's like, tell me where to go, and I'll blast through it. So he's got some learning to do, and it's a new system. So obviously it's too early to give up on him, but he doesn't have a lot going for him. He's not getting a lot of help, and he's not helping himself.
R.J. Clifford is with us. R.J. Clifford, MMA, SiriusXM Combat Channel experts. I want to get back to the Raiders in a couple minutes, but let's continue on it for now. Looking ahead, this is a weird spot, and the Raiders are certainly not a team that should be looking ahead to anyone, but the challenge becomes a little different because I think they were going to be fed someone real weak at quarterback or real confused in Bryce Young. I'm going to make the case here that the Panthers are more dangerous with Andy Dalton at quarterback.
Well, Andy Dalton's had the Raiders' number the last, like, 3, 4, 5 times he's played us. So, yeah, like, I would agree with you. I feel like the Panthers are a mess all over the place, but, yeah, I would much rather face a second-year player who looks like a deer deer in the headlights than a seasoned veteran, and especially one like, and we see it all the time when, you know, veterans come off the bench, you don't have the same tape in that system, you don't have, you know, 2 weeks for a defensive coordinator to look at what they're going to do. Obviously, there's a ton of tape on Andy Dalton in the league forever, but in this specific scheme with these receivers, you know, with this setup, like, is it going to be a little different? I mean, I don't think anyone's quivering in their boots for Andy Dalton, but I mean, wouldn't it be the most Raider things ever as 9-point dogs to go across the country, knock off the Ravens, and then in the home opener lose to the worst team in football? I mean, that would be the most Raiders thing ever. I'm trying to anti-jinx it, Steve, by saying it out loud. Hopefully it works. I've just been watching this team too long to not be a little nervous that there shouldn't be trap games. You're the Raiders, you're 1-1, but it's trap gamey-esque.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the hardest thing for squads that haven't won consistently is to deal with prosperity, and now they look up after an upset win. They're 1-1, and you've got Panthers on the way, Browns on the way, Steelers in the offing who cannot do anything on offense. So they have a chance here if they take care of business to really get out to a good start.
And Broncos before Steelers. I mean, they should, they could be, they, like, odds-wise, they should probably be 4-1 before they face Pittsburgh.
I talked over you there. Don't say it. They'll have a good record. Don't mention a specific record. You know better.
I know better. But look, you get one great win, and all of a sudden I start thinking Super Bowl. You know me, Steve. I can't help it.
Why not? I think Dana White was thinking Super Bowl with his Sphere show, and the presentation was the Super Bowl. It was freaking awesome. But then he comes out of it, and he's kind of, like, disappointed and lamenting what happened in the last two fights. Can I tell you, I thoroughly enjoyed the Marab fight against Sean O'Malley because I love grappling, and I love strikers who don't train the right way and can't defend the takedown. And Griffin was hanging. Actually, we were here at Ellis Island. I enjoyed every second of that fight. If you can't grapple and you can't wrestle, then you're getting laid on, brother.
There's a reason why there's a wrestling test for every big prospect in mixed martial arts. And you can tell when guys get to avoid it. Alex Bejeda has yet to face a wrestler of any caliber. And one, it's because there's not a lot in the weight class. So in fairness there. But two, he's a kickboxer. How's he going to do? The UFC did not match up Sean O'Malley against a single wrestler on his way up until he fought Aljamain Sterling. And I know Aljamain Sterling's a college wrestler, good takedown artist, but even he isn't a blast, double leg, you know, take you down the center of the octagon type of wrestler. He's like, kick his way in, punch his way in, get a clinch, push you against the cage, and drag you down. You saw that when he fought Henry Cejudo, an Olympic gold medalist wrestler. In the open mat, Cejudo got all the takedowns. Against the cage, Sterling got all the takedowns. And so because of that, O'Malley was able to knock him out. Against Rob Dvalishvili, O'Malley looks flat. He normally lands roughly like 7 punches per minute. He was landing about just barely over 1 per minute against Rob Dvalishvili. And Marab's just that animal. Like there are obviously tons of wrestlers in mixed martial arts. No wrestler is like Marab Dvalishvili. Well, he doesn't even need the takedown to get you out of your game. All he has to do is shoot takedown because he's relentless. He has cardio for days. He's cockroach. He can't be killed. And he can do that for 25 minutes. And that's what he's able to do against Sean O'Malley. Just O'Malley's just on his back foot, lost, afraid to throw because he's got this 5'6" Georgian in his grill for 25 minutes.
I loved it so much because it really is the tale of the UFC over the years. And I know it drives Dana White nuts. And he was so mad after Bilal won. And I'm like, you keep booking these fights where a grappler is going to control the fight. There were two dudes sitting behind us who got so mad, they just started screaming out anti-gay slurs about the style of the fight. And I turned around, I'm like, you guys are some of the most effeminate dudes I've ever seen. I was just laughing. Like, this is MMA, man. You got to be well-rounded. And then the other one was, while I'm going to sound like I'm anti-female, and I don't know if it's different, but I know the Shevchenko approach drove Dana White nuts as well because she's better than Grasso at that skill set, and she did what she had to do to win the fight.
Well, look at both these scenarios, right? Like, Valentina Shevchenko, by every possible metric, right? This is a trilogy with Alexa Grasso. In the first and second fight, Valentina Shevchenko, despite going 0-1-1 against Grasso, led in every category. There were 7 rounds that were unanimous. She won 4. She landed like something like 8 more significant strikes. Again, this is the first 2 fights. She had 10 minutes more control time. She had 8 takedowns, relinquishing 0. And she still wasn't able to beat Alexa Grasso because she got absolutely robbed with one of the craziest scorecards they ever saw in that draw last time. So she's like, all right, screw you guys. I'm not taking any chances. She can't defend a double leg. She wants to do 1997 jiu-jitsu off of her back and not get up. I'm going to take her down, hold her, and win 50-45. I'm not risking another terrible, terrible judge's scorecard. And on the flip side, you got Marab Dvalishvili, who literally had to rack up 11 fight win streak over Olympic gold medalists, Hall of Famers, world-class boxers, title challengers, had to unanimously decide, like, beat all these guys in a row just for a chance to fight Sean O'Malley. You think he's going to be like, hey, I'm going to start doing some flying knees and spinning back fists to make a show? He's like, no, because if I lose, I'm never getting back here again. I'm going to dance with who brought me here. And he dominated. He absolutely dominated. I can't believe there were 248-47 scorecards. I mean, I can see him giving O'Malley 5th round. He completely dominated, as he should have. It is he gave a double bird to everyone else. And this should be a feel-good story. He's the guy that did it the hard way and did it over the teacher's pet, Sean O'Malley. Like, this is the feel-good story. Marab Dvalishvili winning, not Sean O'Malley.
Now, the ultimate feel-good story for Dana White is the setting, the show. It was awesome. I wasn't in the arena. You were around it. It on TV, I'm sure it was even better in the arena. It was awesome on TV.
There was one of the moments where I think it was in the pay-per-view, they started doing those 90-second mini films, and you start going from world to world. One of the films, I think it was the second or third one, the one with the marigolds, it starts pushing into the scene, and it kind of stops into this, like, city town square. And I'm not lying to you, Steve. I'm sitting in my chair. I literally, like, lunged forward as if I was in a car approaching a stop sign. Like, my body physically, like, jarred, preparing to stop. It was just that epic. And props to the UFC for taking a risk. Like, if this fell on its face, they would be the laughingstock. You invested $20 million. You're going up against Canelo on Mexican Independence Day weekend. You know, you overstepped your bounds. You got over your skis, and now you got egg on your face. But they didn't. Like, UFC's widely successful, obviously the most popular and profitable combat sport entity in the world, and they're still like, let's take this risk. Let's try something different. People are mad about going to the Apex. All right, how about this? Let's do something you've never seen before. And they pulled it off, and it was a lot of work, and it was a lot of money, but they pulled it off. They took that risk, and it's like they tell their fighters all the time, you want to be a superstar, you want to be a champion, you want pay-per-view money, you want to be a millionaire, show up when the lights are the brightest and deliver when everyone's looking. And the UFC held themselves to that standard.
RJ, you're the best, man. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you next Monday, okay?
I'll be there. Thanks, guys.
at RJ Clifford MMA, at the Windbags. That's the Autumn Windbags podcast. Very good podcast. If you think we yell at each other, RJ and his partner Juan, they flip out. It's very entertaining, very informative as well. So we're hanging out at Ellis Island, the front yard. Monday Night Football just kicked off, scoreless 2.5 minutes in. So we're thrilled to be here every Monday. Steve Sears is our guy here.
Yes.
And Steve has put together another stop on the summer tour, Willie.
The 11th annual.
11th annual Bikini Tug of War.
Correct.
By the way, guess who I offered the co-hosting slot to tomorrow?
Who? Oh, are you coming? Oh, I mean, it's not really maybe, you know, your thing or anything. It's just
no, I think it is his thing. He had prior arrangements, and he got late notice.
Yeah. All right.
I'm disappointed that you're not going to see this.
By the way, we have history, and he's always been wonderful to me, this guy right here. So just
he's wonderful to everybody.
And how come you guys don't have any pork bites or at least fried pickles?
Well,
I mean, the food, I mean, you know, it's calm.
Well,
I will say we're getting food, but last week we ran a live video, and the first thing on the video – you could see Greg Salerno just like eating his burger and fries
and while trying to do the show.
We're like, you know what happened? We came back from break. I said, hey, you know what? You eat. I have to do something for like 2 minutes, so go ahead. But then it was like, you know, he's got a big face. But he enjoyed it. That burger, the drive-in burger for $7 is one of the craziest things I've ever seen. That's
well,
really good.
I like the $30 unlimited beer, too, during the game.
All you can drink beer is $30. All you can eat food special as well.
By the way, you know, Cofield came and watched the UFC Sphere fights here on our 20-foot screen. It looked pretty awesome.
It was dynamite.
Have you talked to people that went? I've gotten mixed reviews on people that went.
Who didn't like it inside?
I don't know. Well, a couple people, I think, is because the last couple fights weren't. I said, yeah, but, you know, Dana can't control that. You control everything.
Right.
I thought it was cool. I loved the confetti when it looked like it was coming down. I said that was cool. So I think they were just upset because the person they bet didn't win.
Right?
Right.
That's what I thought, too.
Yeah.
Because we were by some dudes who got really mad, and I'm like, they clearly bet Sean O'Malley.
Exactly.
And they didn't get the fight they thought they were going to get. So, okay, the Bikini Tug of War, we got at least a half dozen teams.
We do. Randy Couture is the official weigh-in master because girls, you know, teams of three girls, you have to be under 400 pounds. This is a sanctioned event. It's not a BS event. I pay $80 a year to be part of
80?
The American.
I kept saying it was only 39. I didn't know you
80.
Paid 80. Wow, okay.
$80 a year to be part of the American Association of Tug of War.
Used to be officials there.
I'm the official.
He's the official. He's a licensed referee in tug.
Correct.
Will Mark Ratner be there too?
We're going to make a late call to see if Mark can come over.
The commissioner of the Nevada Boxing Commissioner?
He was, sure.
Okay. He used to be there, and then he was also the head of the SNOA, which is Southern Nevada Officials Association, and Nevada's official. I mean, every sporting event, he's there just to make sure everybody is doing their job.
I mean, tug of war, though, and
then I'm showing
bikini him tug of war with Mark. I'm not sure.
So anyway, teams of three girls, they have to be total team weight under 400 pounds because we did have a year. I don't want to say who, Sin City Roller Girls. We're a little. So now we have to have a weight limit.
Yeah, they were strong.
And I did get a little hate mail about I was fat shaming or something. I'm like, no, I'm just trying to make it fair. So a weigh-in with Randy Couture is between 2 and 3. We start tugging at 3. And so a lot of times tonight can't be on the radio, so I'm glad. And Cindy will be there, my co-host. And then you guys can interview Randy. Also got Green Lumber coming, our sponsor.
Yeah, you swear by
so
those
that's
guys.
Pretty good, yeah. So
why do you swear by them?
Just because it works.
What do you take? Willie's big into the supplements.
Okay, I take one, the gut relief, because I always have. I'm not saying I'm ready to try real dairy again. But my stomach's been better than it's ever been, so I got to say.
I mean, look at this guy.
Then I have daily offense. I'm 60.
He's a boxer.
Yeah.
I know, but you know how old he is? Look at him.
I'm 60.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Anyway, and
you ever heard of shark cartilage?
Uh-uh.
I take shark cartilage.
You do? Okay.
Maybe Green Lumber has it.
Well, I don't know.
Let's
but,
ask
but
tomorrow.
You'll find out tomorrow.
And,
he's a great guy.
And I also take kratom. Look that up.
Okay.
Take a look at kratom.
Well, I mean, I got Green Lumber tattooed on my my rectum right now. Yeah, just because that's my guy. And he's one of my players. He's a gambler, so.
Live tomorrow, Plaza Pool, 2 o'clock weigh-in, 3 o'clock start of the show.
Free
and then
to
the tugging begins, and it's free to locals.
Free to locals, a lot of drink specials. And the girls really get into it. So right now I've got 5-6 teams. I'd like a couple more. So if there's any singles out there, you can just show up. We weigh in, sign a waiver, and you can tug.
Are we official with the entrance of Palomino?
Palomino is definitely in. I've talked to them twice.
Okay. You knew basically worked that deal for you.
Adam Hill.
Yes.
Yeah, no, and
he's very influential.
They acknowledge that. Sapphire is in for sure, Crazy Horse 3, Rhino's in for sure, Palomino's in for sure, Buffalo Wild Wings. And so, you know, I'd like 7. That's really good. 10's too many, but it's a double elimination, kind of a round robin thing.
Will you make a prediction on the final?
I think Peppermint Hippo is coming to reclaim their crown.
But who's coming? Who else is coming after him?
Buffalo Wild Wings.
Yep.
What is this new joint? You just rattled them all off, but
The one that's called the Strip Club or something.
Now, do you know the Strip Club? They pilfered, but not pilfered. But they
stole.
Stole, but there's a
acquired.
Begins with the
playing paint. A game now.
They got a lot of the talent from servers to dancers. From HIPAA.
Oh, really?
It's kind of like they went into the portal.
They went into the transfer portal.
We need to find a contact because it's not too late. I just need 3 girls under 400 pounds, and they could go.
Hook them up.
I've got trophies, medals. It's all
something
first
tells
class.
Me that won't be a problem at the strip club.
You could have some bitter ex-hippos.
Here's the reason I want more teams is I know you'll find this shocking, but sometimes those teams flake.
Yep.
And I might think I'm going to have 10 and 4 show up or 3 show up. So that's why the more the merrier.
I'm ready.
All right. Well, I'll see you tomorrow, Cofield. I'll be there early.
Steve's going to bed right now.
No.
He's getting ready. He's going to bed right
now. No, but it is a more work than you think, but it's fun. You've got the same cabana as last year. So
sweet.
A lot of drink specials.
We'll send it back to the studio. Coming up, Paul Carcaterra, ESPN, was working the sidelines. We'll get his take on UNLV and Kansas. All right. Back here, Ellis Island. Front yard. Cofield and Company, Steve Cofield, Willie Ramirez. We got a scoreless game right now. Eagles on the move at about the 20-yard line. Had a good conversation today, Willie, with Paul Carcaterra, who's working the sidelines for ESPN in the UNLV-Kansas game in Kansas City. And there's some really good stuff in here about Matt Sluka, stuff I actually didn't know about. So Paul really dug up some really good stuff about Sluka and his lacrosse playing background. But we started off the conversation talking about the fact that, man, it was crazy in there. There were some wild officials' calls in terms of getting first downs. I couldn't tell, you know, when they were measuring if the Rebels got a first down on the fourth and short, if they got the touchdown. And the other thing was the Rebels' pace of play was completely different than you'd expect, right, Paul?
Yeah, you know, for a team in UNLV who likes to play really fast, that drive is around 9 minutes long. And it felt like an eternity once they got into the red zone because of the penalties and getting pushed back and then getting first downs and then being pushed back again. And then ultimately, when the ball crossed the goal line, I was interested to see the clock situation too, because, you know, it was a big enough type of drama to see if the ball actually crossed, but also took 9 seconds to go 1 yard too, which I felt was pretty long too. So that last touchdown had so many little pieces to it that you could go back and watch. But I think it was the drive as a whole that was the most profound for me, because of the fact that we know UNLV and the way that they play offense, you know, how fast they snap the ball. You think of short drives, but they just absolutely blowtorch that clock in the fourth quarter when they had to.
So for you, what was the biggest narrative that came out of the game?
You know, I think it was buckling down on defense for UNLV. In the first half, specifically the first quarter, I thought Kansas came out pretty strong with their run game and Devin Neal. And I didn't think it was going to be a situation where UNLV was going to be able to hold up and withstand that power run game. Devin Neal is one of the best backs that Kansas has ever had. I mean, he's a record-breaking back. He's a 4-year player for them, and he's had an unbelievable career. And when you see him getting going early and just the leverage that was, you know, being won by the offensive line of Kansas against the defensive line of UNLV, I just thought they were in for a long physical day, but they really adjusted. And then when they stopped the run in pieces in the second half, I thought they did a good job pressuring, you know, Jalen Daniels, the Kansas quarterback, who threw 3 picks. So I think when they were able to establish an identity and stopping the run, it allowed them to be a little bit more complex with their coverages and show some different things to rattle Daniels in the pass game.
Yeah, I was at the bowl game last year, and talking to Paul Carcaterra, who was working the UNLV Kansas game in Kansas City. At the bowl game, Justin Bean was outstanding. So he was a backup last year. Then Daniels goes down. Bean was unreal. He threw for 449 and 6 touchdowns. And I don't know, Daniels, there's some question marks here now, because you've had back-to-back games where he's making mistakes, judgment calls. I wonder what they do at quarterback. I can tell you this. I was the crowd that was around me, and of course all crowds are impatient. They started chanting the backup's name, which I was kind of surprised by.
Yeah, you know, and Daniels is a guy who had a really strong 2022 to the extent that he was the preseason Big 12 Offensive Player of the Year a year ago. And that was a conference in the Big 12 that had Texas, Oklahoma, and all those other teams in it too. So like, he obviously has a really, really high ceiling, but he was injured last year, you know, and didn't have the, you know, the full spring and was nicked up. And I think that didn't allow him to get into a groove in this early stage of the season. He's thrown 6 picks in 2 games. In the previous 12 games prior to that, he had 5 total interceptions. So we're seeing totally different type of play out of a quarterback that you thought going into the season would be, you know, a strength for the team.
So we talked about the defense kind of nutting up and some scheme changes for UNLV. On the other side, the story was Matt Sluka, who I don't think a lot of people know unless they watched FCS football and Holy Cross, but what a show he put on. And man, he was clutch, escaping so many times with his legs.
You know, he was amazing with his legs. I thought watching him, he stood out in terms of a blend of physicality, you know, with his brute force, because he's not a small guy, but he is agile and he's really good on his feet. He's light on his feet. He made a couple spectacular runs that changed the game. I mean, that one third down that he had in the fourth quarter, he was dead to rights. And then he runs for, you know, over 10 yards where it looked like there was 3 or 4 Kansas guys that absolutely had him in their grasp. And I think Sluka is able to improvise too. That's what you get with a player like that. You know, he was the Patriot League Offensive Player of the Year a season ago playing for Holy Cross. They had an historic year where you know, their coach ends up going to JMU as a result of the success. And there's a bunch of guys in the portal. And I think Sluka would have been really sought after if he didn't graduate from Holy Cross, because when he decided to go in the portal, a lot of the big dogs were knocking down to see if they could get him to play quarterback for them. But it was very important to him, and I spoke to him about it, for him to stay at Holy Cross in the spring and get his degree. He thought it was a 40-year decision. By doing that, he kind of pushed aside a bunch of schools that wanted him, because those schools wanted him in the spring for spring ball. And, you know, he stayed at Holy Cross. He worked out with a lot of his teammates who were also going in the portal. And UNLV was willing to wait. And that's stressful, too, because when you have a quarterback who's verbally committed to you in the portal, like, things can change. Like, you have your word and, you know, you're in a position where you think that he's saying he's coming, so he's coming. But who's to say the last second there's another injury to a quarterback at a Power 4 school in the spring, and maybe they say, well, we're going to take Sluka now regardless, even if he did miss spring ball. So I credit Barry Odom and the staff for taking Sluka by his word. I credit Sluka for having a plan to graduate and make that 40-year decision. But I just think he's a dynamic, tough athlete. There was a couple balls he threw in the first half. There was that one bomb he threw to De Jesus that I thought he should have caught too. It's not that this guy's just a runner. Like, he has the arm and the ability to throw deep. He's got some touch to it. The final seconds, which could have been a disaster in the second quarter. I mean, the clock management by Barry Odom and the staff there was a little questionable. I mean, Barry Odom's a fantastic coach. I loved my time with him last week. I'm a huge fan. The last seconds of that second quarter were questionable, and they got bailed out by Sluka, who made a beautiful pass to the corner of the end zone too. So we talk about his legs and his toughness making plays on the ground, but he showed some spots where he can throw the ball.
You mentioned how much you like Barry Odom. Why?
You know, I think he's relatable. I think he has a plan. He obviously is is a defensive mastermind. I mean, he really knows how to coach. I thought he got a raw deal at Missouri, and then he spends a couple years at Arkansas as the DC and did a great job there. And
right,
you know, we brought over Jackson Woodard too, which helps too. The former walk on at Arkansas now is a tackling machine for UNLV. And speaking to Woodard, just the way that he you know, broke down his relationship with Odom and what Odom stands for. You could tell he's all about the right things. I think UNLV has a fantastic coach too. And being relatable is so important this day and age. You want a tough-minded, old-school football coach that, you know, is all about technique and fundamentals, but you have to be able to relate to the new generation. And I think he's a nice combination of both.
Yeah, there's three things. He's embraced the transfer portal, and he told us locally that he hated it when it first started. And his wife actually told him, like, you got to embrace this. You're going to drive yourself crazy. The other thing is that defensive line against the offensive line, I've never seen someone rotate defensive linemen, especially a group of five. He played nine different guys, eight-plus plays. And he's a guy who I think learned from his last trip as head coach. From what I'd heard, he really didn't embrace the media and that he embraces us all the time, which you don't have to do. But it's only going to help you. You don't want to have a thorn in your side with the media. So I think he's one of those guys second time around who's learned a lot of lessons and he's applying it to this group of five program.
No, I think that's a great point too. It's like life's all about lessons and how you learn. You know, he's definitely a little bit more open-minded, you know, with the media and just the way things have changed. I mean, college football has changed more in 4 years than it had in the prior 100, right?
Like
just
right.
It's just absolutely insane. So it takes a nimble coach that understands that to make the adjustments. But, you know, I also think if you look at the rest of his staff, it's interesting too, because he has like an old school mentality defensively. But when you look at that offense, I mean, that offense is drastically different than the way they play defense. I mean, Brennan Marion is a very intriguing offensive coordinator. I say this too because when we sat down with him last week, just his journey, you know, playing for Gus Malzahn in college and the different stops that he had along the way as a college assistant coach, but also one that really stood out to me. He told me that he coached one of the worst teams in California. He was a high school coach in California, where there was 18 players playing against some of the best teams in California that had a ton of college commits. And he had to be creative offensively. And he relates his offense to like street basketball, where there's a lot of improv and it's not scripted. And when you have a street hoops mentality, you're not going to be pigeonholed into one spot and you're going to force your team and your players to think, right? Like it's not so scripted. It's not like we're going to do this route and it's going to be like this every time. Like he mentioned how he wants his wide receivers to react and based off the way that the defense is playing and the opposition, what they give them, there's going to be options on all of these plays too. So I think he's a coach, Barry Odom, that understands you can play defense one way, but you have to be creative offensively and you have to differentiate yourself too, because if you're UNLV and you're bringing in these players and you know, you got some talent, but if you're going to beat, you know, two Power Four teams already this season, you got to do it with some scheme too. And you got to be different. You can't do what everyone else is doing. And I think this team doesn't.
Paul Carcaterra is with us, recapping UNLV and Kansas here on Cofield and Company on a Monday. You played lacrosse. You were a really good lacrosse player at Syracuse. Let's puff out the chest here about lacrosse with Sluka, because that's one of the things Sluka points to. And actually, Marion pointed to it as well, that a lot of Sluka's movement and, you know, kind of shakiness and slipperiness, he credits to playing lacrosse over the years.
Yeah, I mean, Sluka was a phenomenal high school midfielder from Long Island, you know, which is in New York. And it's a hotbed for lacrosse. So, like, the best high school players in the country, many of them are coming from Long Island. I mean, you look at the past, you know, great players in the sport, Tourton winners, national champions. So many of them are rooted, and their success comes from where they started playing. It's on Long Island. And, you know, Sluka played in a tough division in high school where you're playing against teams like Chaminade and St. Anthony's, which are top five, top 10 teams nationally every single year. But he also played in the summer on the club circuit with the best players on Long Island. He was a phenomenal high school midfielder after talking to some people. And I was in touch with Pat Cavanaugh, who's a two-time national champ at Notre Dame, who graduated last year. He played summer ball with Sluka. And, you know, Liam Entman, national champ from Long Island at Notre Dame, and, you know, first-round draft pick in the Pro League, played with Sluka. Sluka played with the best of the best, and Cavanaugh was telling me that, like, his athleticism and his middle-of-the-field presence, he was an absolute beast. How does that translate to football? It's pretty simple. If you're watching a midfielder in lacrosse, you're watching a midfielder in soccer, when you're light on your feet and you have the ability to do those quick little jabs and plant foot type of moves where you change direction, and then obviously the stamina to run the field, you see that in him as a quarterback too. He told me he thought about lacrosse, but there was that urge to be different and want to play football, ultimately won out. But if he decided to play lacrosse, he would have played at the highest level. And you know, he would have been a phenomenal college midfielder. You see that size and power and speed, that combination would have been an outlier on the field.
Let's spend the last couple of minutes here with Paul Carcaterra talking about what's ahead. First, for Kansas, do you think they make a switch at quarterback? Is Kansas season in the tank? I wouldn't give up on anyone. I still think Kansas can have a very good season.
I do too. I mean, Kansas is one of the most veteran teams in the country too. That's the hard thing. Lance Leipold has his most veteran team he's had. And, you know, they won 9 games last year. They haven't played a conference game yet. So, like, to think that their season's in the tank would be totally premature. I think they could certainly turn it around. You look at Leipold over the years, though, they were trending in a direction to maybe even be a 10-win season. I don't think that's possible right now. Leipold got there. They were 2-10. Second year, 6-7. Last year, 9-4. Now they're 1-2. But like I said, they haven't played a conference game. And no, I do not see them making a change at quarterback. I think Jalen Daniels has too much experience, too much credibility in that locker room to bail on him this early. I think he's got to have a couple more disaster games to pull the plug. They have a backup that they like in Cole Ballard, who's, you know, from Indianapolis. His dad's actually the GM of the Indianapolis Colts. So, you know, he's a quarterback of the future. I just don't think they make that switch right now. Look, if you're Kansas, there was so much momentum coming into the season. You know, you win the 9 games, maybe you're going to get to 10 wins. I mean, Lance Leipold has the Gateway District project. It's $300 million towards their new stadium. That's opening next year. So they're going to have one of the best facilities in terms of game day experience. Back-to-back bowl wins, only the second time in school history. So, like, there's a lot of momentum there. But it has been a very disappointing start to the season. Because, like you said, they were a team that had high expectations. And I think, you know, people were thinking at this point in the season, if you look on paper and what they had back, 3-0 was what I think a lot of fans thought was going to happen, not 1-2.
Closing on UNLV, I think they can have a big season, man. Their schedule is really tough. And that includes, actually, after a bye week, Fresno at home, and then your Orange, actually a very unique spot that an ACC team is going to come out to play UNLV at Allegiant Stadium.
Look, I think that was a game that, you know, before the season started, people were like, oh, Syracuse against UNLV. Look, that's going to be a great game now. Syracuse is going to get tested this week with Stanford. Stanford's a team in the ACC now, as crazy as that sounds, right? They're going on the road to play conference foe literally across the entire country from California to New York. So I think we're going to learn a little bit more about Syracuse then, because, you know, Stanford has a ton of players returning from last year. I think Iowa State's the only team that has more returning production back this season ahead of Stanford. You know, I think 85% of their production's back for Stanford. Iowa State had 86. So, like, they're bringing back so much of their team. But I think Syracuse is an interesting team too, because you have Kyle McCord, who's, you know, he's got 8 touchdown passes in 2 games. He was Ohio State's starting quarterback a year ago. And I think he's brought in a ton of juice to that Syracuse program. And Fran Brown's one of those first-year coaches that I think the fan base is kind of rallying behind. So I look at that game. It's going to be an awesome game.
There he is, Paul Carcaterra. He was working the sidelines for UNLV and Kansas. good connect there because he's a guy who played lacrosse. Matt Sluka has this deep lacrosse background, and you're seeing it in his running style. We were told by multiple people his lax background, man, that changes everything in terms of his mobility and slipperiness, and it's showing. And that was a good point by Carcaterra on Sluka and UNLV coming together was not the easiest thing because Sluka wanted to finish out school and UNLV was willing to commit to him and vice versa. So it's worked out so far to a 3-0 start. We're hanging out here giving away prizes, including all you can eat, all you can drink, a package for two for Sunday football viewing. So get on out of here, front yard. Thanks to Ellis Island for housing the show. Thanks to Willie and Steve Shearer came on. All our great guests, Mateo with the excellent setup. It's Cofield. Get out here. Eagles and Falcons, plenty of game left. You can check it out here at Ellis Island.